Coming up, abortion, a contentious issue in the healthcare debate. And thousands of volunteers join together to help provide basic services in a financially troubled city. Plus, this young girl is autistic. She cannot speak, but she's found her voice writing more than 90 poems.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Tim O'Brien, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thanks for joining us. Step by step, Congress is moving forward on health care reform, and religious groups are among those mobilizing around the issue. After the Senate Finance Committee approved its health care plan this week, both the House and Senate are now preparing their various bills for full debate. Many questions are yet to be resolved, and faith groups across the spectrum are lobbying for their particular concerns. One of the most contentious issues within the religious community is the extent to which health care reform should allow any type of federal funding for abortion coverage, even indirect funding. Kim Lawton reports.
All five committees defeated amendments that would have stopped an abortion mandate.
Abortion opponents have already launched an aggressive lobbying campaign. This new ad is from the group Americans United for Life.
For Life Action.
Polling shows over 70% of Americans don't want to see their tax dollars going for it. So that's what this debate is over, is not whether or not you agree or disagree with abortion, but whether or not at the federal level we're going to pay for it.
Meanwhile, an interfaith group called the Religious Institute gathered signatures of more than 1,000 clergy affirming access to abortion.
We believe that abortion should be safe, legal, rare, and accessible. And that a health care reform should not make it more difficult for women to get abortions in this country.
In his address to a joint session of Congress last month, President Obama made a clear promise.
Under our plan, no federal dollars will be used to fund abortions.
But working that out legislatively has been complicated. The current House and Senate proposals do not explicitly prohibit abortion coverage. Congressional leaders say the bills would comply with the so-called Hyde Amendment, which restricts most abortion funding in Medicaid. Abortion opponents say that's not good enough.
Unless there's an explicit exclusion of abortion, abortion will be in health care reform.
Yost and her fellow activists also object to proposed compromises that would require insurance plans offering abortion coverage to keep public and private funds separate and use only the private funds to pay for abortions.
A lot of the solutions that we see involve a lot of really fancy accounting gimmicks, and that's exactly what it is. Is it's just moving money around from pot to pot in order to try to promote this fiction that somehow we're not paying for it just because the money's being funneled through a particular channel.
But pro-choice activists say given the legal right to abortion, that compromise is the very least Congress owes women.
There may be a lot of medical services that I might disagree with, that I wouldn't want a member of my family to have, but that's not up to me. If we care about the very difficult situations that women and families find themselves in, that out of that compassion, we would make sure that women would have access to all options.
Faith-based moderates and liberals have been actively pushing for health care reform as a moral issue. Many are worried that abortion debates will derail their efforts.
We think that in some sense is a distraction. I mean, it's an important issue, very important issue. But in the context of a country where a growing number of millions and millions of people do not have insurance, health insurance, we feel that's more the main issue for this particular debate.
The issue has already become a rallying point for religious conservatives.
The American people will not stand for government-run insurance that uses taxpayer money to fund abortions in this country.
I'm really disappointed that once again women's lives, the desperate situation that so many women find themselves in, the desperate situation that so many poor women face is being used as a political football. I think it's morally unconscionable that we are segregating some health services. Abortion's a health service.
But abortion opponents say that's precisely the view they're fighting against.
It's really troubling to us that we face a future where we might not be able to make a fundamental difference between abortion and a tonsillectomy. For millions of Americans across this country, abortion is a morally objectionable activity. And so for us to lose the ability to differentiate with a tonsillectomy would be a real, real tragedy.
Activists on both sides of the abortion issue are mobilizing for some key battles in the next few weeks. Both the House and the Senate are expected to begin floor debates on health care reform by the end of the month. And the Obama administration hopes a final bill will be passed by the end of the year. I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
Faith groups are also divided on another issue in the news this week, gay rights. Religious leaders were among both supporters and opponents of a mass march for gay rights in Washington and of a speech President Obama gave to the Human Rights Campaign. The president pledged to end the military's controversial policy, known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and allow gays to join the services without restriction. In other news, the Reverend Sun Myung Moon is handing over day-to-day operations of the Unification Church he founded to his daughter and three sons. The church claims more than 100,000 members and a network of businesses worldwide. It may be best known for the mass weddings Moon has performed. He oversaw one of the largest this past week in South Korea. 10,000 couples, most of them chosen for each other by the church, took vows or renewed them. 10,000 more couples participated remotely from other countries. At the Vatican, African bishops spoke out against what they called the cultural imperialism of many Western aid programs. The bishops are in Rome for a special meeting to address the role of the Catholic Church in Africa. One of the most closely watched discussions has been about the church's ban on condoms, which is at odds with humanitarian groups that support condoms to stop the spread of AIDS. The bishop said promoting condom use was an example of the West trying to impose its views on Africa. In Iraq, the government released its first official tally of civilian war deaths. It said more than 85,000 Iraqi civilians were killed between 2004 and 2008, and almost 150,000 were wounded. The number includes 15,000 unidentified bodies that were never claimed by families and are buried in special cemeteries. In Indonesia, officials have given up the search for the missing after the earthquake that devastated that country last month. The death toll stands at more than 1,100. Humanitarian groups and faith-based organizations are working to meet the demands of a region that remains in desperate need. Thousands have been left homeless with only minimal support from the government. Officials said the homeless are eligible for 50 cents a day for up to a month. In this country, President Obama made his first visit to New Orleans since becoming president. In connection with the visit, a coalition of some of the nation's most influential religious leaders asked him to prioritize recovery for the region. In a letter signed by the leaders of the National Council of Churches, the Islamic Society of North America, the Episcopal Church, and the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, among others, the coalition urged more federal attention to long-term recovery that addresses poverty, coastal erosion, and climate change. Most of us have seen, if not personally experienced, the devastating effects of the recent economic downturn. But as bad as it has been for some, for others it has provided unusual opportunities to help out, to do good. Some 26,000 volunteers in Portland, Oregon, are pooling their talents in just such an effort. It's called Season of Service. Our reporter is Lucky Severson.
Volunteers signed up by the thousands to lend a helping hand to people in need. And here in Portland, Oregon, where unemployment reached 12% this year, there are a lot of people in need. And with tax revenues down, the city needs help providing even basic services, like maintaining public schools, particularly in low-income neighborhoods. Roosevelt High, for instance, might get a visit from a maintenance man once this year, if it's lucky. Devin Baker is an administrator at Roosevelt.
It does something for you in your heart, you know, if you're one of the staff members and suddenly the building is clean, it's ready to go. It's a real partnership with a lot of folks. It just really makes you feel like, wow, people really do care.
What makes this effort so extraordinary is not that it's church members doing the volunteering. There are about 500 churches involved this year, including Catholic and mainline Protestant. But the majority of the 26,000 volunteers are evangelicals, intentionally not here to proselytize, but to show their faith by doing good deeds, such as scrubbing windows and even working in harmony with one of the most liberal cities in the U.S., and its openly gay mayor, Sam Adams.
If I could have them do it every month in my city, I would. So thank you.
The organizer of Season of Service, which is now in its second year, is Kevin Palau.
Portland is a very proudly liberal city. This is not the Bible Belt. And so to have that kind of cooperation between churches and city leaders on a long-term basis, I think is unprecedented.
Palau is the son of Luis Palau, who has staged huge evangelism festivals around the world. His son chose a slightly different path, one he thinks will put Christ's teachings into action and perhaps change the image in a secular city that some have of Christians. The purpose, he says, is not to preach or proselytize.
We're not doing this so that we can preach the gospel. We're doing this to demonstrate the love of Christ. And absolutely, we're not hiding the fact that we want people to come into relationship with Christ. But realistically, through this, it's going to happen more relationally and organically, and that's okay.
Wayne Abbott graduated from Roosevelt.
Season of Service works because Jesus told us that he was here to serve, not be served. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't just take a few minutes out of a busy day in our busy lives every once in a while and do exactly what he did.
The extensive work done sprucing up Roosevelt High outside and in would have cost the city about $200,000. Deborah Peterson is the principal.
When good people of goodwill come together and honor one another and believe in hope, miracles happen, and that's what's happening today.
The church has also raised $100,000 to help the increasing numbers of homeless. Then they sponsored what they call compassion clinics throughout the city, offering free medical and dental care. These clinics were overbooked within the first half hour with mostly uninsured patients. These clinics cared for as many as 200 patients each day, grateful patients. Churches even sponsored a mobile medical truck.
For the church, love has to be a verb, and this is what it looks like.
This is love in action. This is what Christ did for all those 5,000. He fed them. He preached to them. He shared with them, and he loved them.
Love includes free veterinarian care for their pets and haircuts for their owners. Kevin Palau says loving thy neighbor is what Season of Service is all about.
So our hope is that long term, this does lead to a lifestyle of service and sharing the gospel by how we live.
Mayor Adams said the thousands of volunteers had made Portland and its suburbs a better place.
Honestly, we had modest hopes. Well, our modest hopes were greatly exceeded.
Season of Service was topped off with a carnival that may have been as important as any of the other events. An opportunity for families to simply have fun in hard times and experience what neighborly love can do when it's put into practice. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson reporting.
Two new government studies indicate autism is far more common than previously thought. That 1 in 100 kids in the U.S., about 673,000 children, suffer from this complex an often devastating neurological disorder. Greater awareness, broader definitions, and spotting autism in younger children may explain some of the increase. But federal health officials say autism is becoming more prevalent, and they cannot explain why. For families and society, autism presents an array of medical and ethical dilemmas. Independent producer Charlie Ryan and correspondent Bob Faw report on one family's battle against autism, a test of faith and hope.
Sometimes, for an autistic child like Elizabeth, cheered on here by her father.
Come on, turn. You can do it. Good.
Sometimes there are small victories.
Excellent.
Then the demons of autism loosen their grip. Too often, though, for Elizabeth, there are other moments of seemingly impenetrable darkness and frustration.
Okay. Easy. Unable to speak, Elizabeth communicates now by finding letters on a letterboard or typing into a keyboard. Even that, says her mother, Ginny, does not spare Elizabeth moments of agony.
I remember so distinctly one of the first things she typed out, A-G-O-N-Y, agony. This was a little six-year-old child, and she knew what agony was. And then she wrote, I need to talk. That was her agony.
She wasn't always like this. In her first 15 months, Elizabeth was healthy, active, alert, even verbal. Then she changed drastically.
Besides the complete loss of language within a week, she did start to have repetitive behavior and have frustrations and tantrums and really kind of left us.
Researchers suspect genetic and environmental factors cause autism. It is characterized by unconventional facial expressions, limited motor and social skills, and difficulty communicating, a life largely dependent. For Elizabeth's parents, that diagnosis was devastating enough, but they were also told there is no reliable treatment, no guaranteed cure. And 10 years later, not that much has changed, says Dr. Anthony Rostain, an expert on autism at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
It really affects almost every aspect of how the child thinks, acts, feels, and develops both cognitively and emotionally. So as a result, it's hard to come up with one-size-fits-all kind of treatment.
Elizabeth's parents, Ginny and Ray, both enjoyed lucrative Wall Street careers, but gave them up to focus on their three children and the battle against autism. Early on, behavioral therapy exercises like this, they were told, might help Elizabeth to organize the chaos in her mind, help her learn how to learn.
Show me jumping. Turn around. Good job. Can you show me sitting? Nice job. Good.
Since she was 3 years old, her school district has paid a full-time professional aide to help Elizabeth academically. This is what a respected speech therapist believed might help loosen Elizabeth's tongue. It turned out to be more fun than effective.
Elizabeth!
There have also been years of special diets and vitamin supplements and homeopathic drops costing hundreds of dollars every month.
There you go.
A $20,000 hyperbaric chamber, which pumps extra oxygen into her brain for an hour every day.
Here we go.
Even unproven therapies like these prism lenses, which distort Elizabeth's vision in hopes of reordering the way her brain processes information.
There you go.
Are you convinced that this has benefits?
I believe that this has helped other children.
Help! Can you say?
And several times, Elizabeth's mother has taken her cross-country, seeking healing in prayer services.
We've used educational interventions, medical interventions. Why not spiritual interventions?
Parents of autistic children face a terrible dilemma. They are forced literally to experiment on their own children because the medical community has not tested or proven those treatments the way it has with treatments for physical conditions like heart disease or cancer.
We're in very, very, very early stages of understanding how medications might improve functioning.
You don't fault a parent for trying everything conceivable.
I don't, because if I had a child who wasn't responding to the treatments that were prescribed by the doctor, I might very well take that child to someone else and someone else and someone else.
What has happened to Elizabeth has happened with countless other autistic children. So many interventions with success only hit or miss. Ethicist Arthur Kaplan.
I could take you online and find tons of quacks, ripoff artists, selling quote-unquote treatments to parents of kids with autism. It is a huge problem.
It is also an ethical minefield. Does society have the responsibility and can it afford to help autistic children who lack the resources lavished on Elizabeth? If so, should that task fall, as it mostly now does, on local public schools?
You can't do it that way. Obviously, different school districts have different amounts of money. We need a national policy to divvy up resources to autistic kids, not the school board budget. That makes no sense at all.
You determined to touch the tea, right?
One intervention which has worked well for Elizabeth began 5 years ago in Austin, Texas, with language therapist Soma Mukhopadhyay, who taught Elizabeth to use the letterboard. Then, a stunning turn in Elizabeth's life. At the urging of her personal education aide, Terry Bird, Elizabeth began writing powerful, often deeply personal poetry, turning some of her frustration into inspiration. And for the first time, those around Elizabeth discovered her inner voice. For example, it's not easy, you see. It's very hard being me. There is so much going on in my mind all of the time.
Why do you write poems?
F-E-E-L-I-N-G.
Feeling?
Or feeling.
Your feelings. That's why you write poems.
Elizabeth is, says her mother, a very spiritual child, and some of her poems are religious.
It does not matter who you are. It does not matter if you stray far. God is always there for you.
Elizabeth has written 90 poems thus far. Many reveal her yearning to be heard.
Did I get it right? Yes, okay.
If only they could walk in my shoes, they would share my news. I am in here and trying to speak every day in some kind of way. I'm in
here. Sentiments echoed in this anthem written for children with autism. Because she can communicate, Elizabeth, accompanied by Terry, also attends a mainstream public school where she excels, especially in math.
Find the greatest common factor of 18 and 24.
Good girl. You know the answer,
Her
huh?
teachers marvel at her performance and persistence.
She taught me about, you know, patience, and I can't even begin to explain to you that I probably learned more from her than I have from anybody in life so far.
Elizabeth is warmly received by other students. Besides writing, Elizabeth can read with remarkable speed, and Terry tests her comprehension.
Doing this job with Elizabeth is the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
Elizabeth's success and her failures, this two steps forward, one step back, have been physically exhausting and emotionally draining for her and her family. It has also severely tested her mother's faith.
It's a natural thing to cry out, "Where are you, God?" I mean, I'm calling here in the darkness, and I can't take too much more sometimes.
And though she on occasion has wavered, her beliefs have emerged stronger.
Thank you for doing it for me.
Has it reinforced your faith?
Absolutely. There are times when I know that we are being blessed on the right path here, and that I'll pray about it and we'll move forward. Let's do our big voice. Ready?
Whether Elizabeth will eventually speak is at best a long shot. She may, her mother concedes, always need assistance, which is why in this household, success is measured one day, one small victory at a time.
I want to be able to say, I have done everything to make my little girl talk. I mean, how can I hear her say, "I'm in agony because I can't speak," and not try something? The data may say only 1%, but if that 1% is Elizabeth, that's all I need. And she wants us to keep trying.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in northern New Jersey.
On our calendar, Tuesday, members of the Baha'i faith honor the birth of their first spiritual leader. Baha'is call him the Bab, or Gate to God. The Bab was born in 1819 in what is now Iran. And this weekend, Hindus, Jains, and Sikhs begin observing one of their most important and popular holidays, Diwali. The five-day festival of light celebrates the victory of light over darkness, or good over evil. It also marks the new year for many Hindus and Jains. This was the first year Diwali was observed by a sitting U.S. president. On Wednesday, President Obama lit a ceremonial lamp in the East Room before an audience of religious leaders. That's our program for now. I'm Tim O'Brien. There's much more on our website, including more resources on autism and a link to the Breen family's website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, the United Voices Choir of the First Baptist Church of Glenarden, Maryland, singing How Majestic Is Your Name.